Blog Talk Radio.
Time travel makes me think of tightrope. Fine lines of what you feel and what you fear most. Years ago, you was on, yeah, you drove the boat. Now you know, ain't no hoe, life's no fucking joke. And they got rules to it. Some things you don't be doing. This ain't no Pro Tools, but we be looping. This ain't no win-lose with no conclusion. Just only how you live today and what you be choosing.
Baby,
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer, right?
Yes.
And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Oh.
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over.
Mr. Jackson,
sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it. I'll see you there.
Starring Gary Dordan from TV CSI.
This is the military, David.
Free the land. Real share ingredients. We'll go to another edition of Georgia University Radio. I'm your host, Blue Mind and Secure, where our goals are fivefold. Our first goal is to eradicate functional literacy among new African prisoners. Our second goal is to eradicate cultural ignorance among new African prisoners. Our third goal is transferring the criminal mentality to the new African mentality. Our fourth goal is to assist in the rebuilding and stabilization of new African communities. Our fifth goal is to prepare a new African prisoner for release, producing new African citizens. Overall goal is transferring the whole prison Dutch slave complex, which is the prison system, into the big institutional learning through educational means. Before I bring on a guest tonight, I'll let go of a couple of events that happened in history during this week. On July the 17th, 1794, Absalom Jones and his followers dedicated the African Church of St. Thomas in Philadelphia. On August 12, 1794, the St. Thomas parishioners affiliated with the Protestant Episcopal Church. Also in 1794, Richard Allen organized Philadelphia Belta African Methodist Episcopal Church. In 1862, the Congress passed the Second Confiscation Act, which freed the slaves of all rebels. In 1862, the Congress authorized the president to accept blacks for military service. In 1863, Union troops were the first Kansas volunteers playing a leading role rooted rebels at Honey Springs, Indian Territory. Black troops captured colors of a Texas regiment. Let me see. In 1959, singer Billie Holiday was considered one of the two or three greatest song stylers in jazz history. Died in New York City at the age of 44. In 1967, hold up. In 1967, from the from the 17th through the 19th, a race riot occurred in Cary, Illinois. National Guard mobilized. Also, in 1967, saxophone stylist John William Coltrane, one of the founders of the modern jazz, died in Huntington, New York at the age of 41. On July 18, 1753, Lemuel Haynes, pioneer black minister, born in West Hartford, Connecticut. In 1863, 54th Massachusetts Volunteers, composed of free blacks of the North, made famous charge on Fort Wagner in Charleston, South Carolina Harbor. Sergeant William H. Kearney won the Congressional Medal of Honor for his bravery in the charge and became the first black soldier to receive the Coveted Award. In 1918, Nelson Mandela was born. He became a symbol for the African struggle for a free South Africa. In 1951, Jersey Joe Walcott defeated Israel Charles for the World Heavyweight Boxing Championship. In 1964, from the 18th through the 22nd, enraged by the shooting of a black youth by off-duty policeman, blacks rebelled in Harlem. The disturbance spread to the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn. In 1966, from the 18th through the 23rd, Governor James A. Rowe declared a state of emergency in Cleveland and dispatched National Guard troops in a riot-torn Hall District. In 1981, the first ever new African Freedom Fighter Day was established. July 19th through the 20th, 1848, Frederick Douglass was the only male to play a prominent role at the first women. Women's Rights Convention at Seneca Falls, New York. He seconded the women's suffrage notion introduced by Elizabeth Cady Stanton. On July 19th through the 23rd, 1919, a race riot occurred in Washington, D.C., triggered by raids on the black residential areas by white soldiers. 6 persons killed, more than 100 wounded. It was became part of what we know as Red Summer. In 1941, the first U.S. Army flying school for black cadets dedicated at Tuskegee, Alabama, at Tuskegee University. The 19th through the 20th in 1967, a riot occurred in Durham, North Carolina. The National Guard mobilized. Oh, I got another date. In 1964, Baka Suja of Georgia University were born. In 1981, Nafria Shakir of Georgia University were born. On July the 20th, 1967. No, I'm going to go back. On July 20, 1925, Dr. Francis Fanon was born. He was a psychiatrist, a revolutionary, an author, and a former political prisoner. In 1967, a riot occurred in Memphis, Tennessee, and National Guard mobilized. Also in 1967, a Black Power Conference took place in Newark, New Jersey. More than 1,000 people attended. It was a 3-day event from the 20th through the 23rd. In 1995, the Southern Baptist Association repudiated historical acts of evil, such as slavery, and apologized to all African Americans for condoning and perpetuating individual and systemic racism. Okay. On July 21st, 1861, Union troops routed at first battle a Bull Run, virtually assuring a long war that would change or end slavery. 1868, 14th Amendment to the Constitution ratified, making African-American citizens and giving them equal protection of the law. That's what they say. In 1950, black troops, a 21st Infantry Regiment, recaptured Yeltsin after a 16-hour battle, scoring the first U.S. victory in the Korean War. In 1962, more than 160 activists jailed after demonstration in Albany. By August 1st, almost 1,000 demonstrators had been arrested in the Georgia city. On July 22nd, in 1862, President Lincoln submitted a one-sentence emancipation proposal to his cabinet, but changed his mind after a protest of conservative advisors. In 1864, Louisiana white voters ratified a new constitution that ended slavery, but did not give the ballot to Louisiana blacks. Under pressure from the military, the Constitutional Convention gave the legislature the power to give the vote to very intelligent citizens and Union veterans. The legislature refused to extend the suffrage to blacks. 1935, Lester Walton was appointed Minister to Liberia. 1939, James Matilda Bowler appointed Judge of the Court of Domestic Relations in New York City by Mayor Fiorelli LaGuardia and became the first black woman judge. On July 23rd, Elijah McCoy, whose father worked as an inventor, led to the saying, the real McCoy, was the first patent out of many more than 50 for a lubricator for heavy machinery in 1872. In 1900, from the 23rd to the 25th, the first Pan-African Congress was held in London, England, organized by Sylvester Williams, a West Indian lawyer. In 1948, from the 23rd to the 25th, the Progressive Party Convention, meeting in Philadelphia, nominated Henry Wallace for president. The new party made major effort to attract blacks. approximately 150 black delegates and alternates attended the convention. The keynote speaker was Charles P. Howell, an attorney, publisher, and former Republican from Des Moines, Iowa. 37 blacks ran for state and local office on a party ticket. 10 blacks ran for Congress. The party attracted few black voters, but forced the Democratic Party to make serious gestures to hold a black vote. In 1968, from the 23rd to the 24th, a race riot occurred in Cleveland. 11 persons, including 3 policemen, were killed and National Guard mobilized. The riot was sparked by an alleged ambush of a police detail. In 1971, William V.S. Tubman, former president of Liberia, died in London at the age of 75. Those are a couple of events that happened in history during this week. But I know it, but you know it's more. I like to say free land to all different identify of land and independence, revolutionary ingredients, free auto catch new African political prisoner, free auto catch new African citizen, new African POW, free auto prison, the Black Liberation Movement, the Pan-African National Movement, free auto political prisoner overall. I'd like to thank everybody who were following our broadcast in 2014. I'd like to salute everybody in their community, their neighborhoods, their organization, their collective, their foundation, their formations for continuing to educate themselves, be a beacon of light within a particular society, organization, collective, or unit. And, you know, I would like to welcome to the show tonight, Brother Licinio Hamilton. How you doing, good brother?
I'm doing all right, yourself?
Yeah, I'm strong, brother. Free to land. I'm strong, brother. Yes, sir. Yes, sir, man. First of all, thank you for coming to our broadcast to share knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. I was sleeping for the work I did in the past, the present, and the future. And may whatever you say be an inspiration to others. But before we start this off, tell the people a little bit about yourself before we get into this. You know, a little bit about yourself, who you are, just a little bit. A little brief bio, so to speak.
I want to start off by saying I'm a conscious new African citizen. My name is Lino Hamilton. I'm from Detroit. In 1994, I was arrested and incarcerated, charged with the murder of my foster mother of 15 years. I was framed by the Detroit police. I spent 27 years in prison for a crime I didn't commit. In September of 2020, the Wayne County Conviction Integrity Unit, the Wayne County Prosecutor, a couple law schools, they filed a motion for me to be released, have my sentence vacated, and it was. A little bit about me, you know, while in prison, I was trying to get out of there, so I realized I needed to educate myself. There were some older brothers who began to mentor me. First book they gave me was Comrade George, The Prison Letters, Solidad Brothers. That sort of started my journey as far as becoming a conscious new African citizen. We can pick it up from here as far as the interview, but that's a little bit about me.
Okay. I understand that. Okay. My first thing I would say, I want to commend you for surviving all them years with your sanity and also with your will and determination to get out from the situation, especially knowing that you wasn't guilty. You know, I want to commend you for that. You know, and my first question is, what actually prepared you to keep fighting, and what were some of the things you did? What were some of the things you did to reach the state you are to gain your freedom?
Well, it was a mixture of things. I was incarcerated when I was 19 years old. You know, street kids, you know, running around doing a lot of garbage. I hadn't really been exposed to a lot of things outside my neighborhood type stuff. But when I got in there, man, I ran across some older brothers who, you know, it's always some older brothers in there trying to mentor or get somebody younger, a little wisdom. And, you know, a lot of people in there say they innocent, but they gave me a little game, man. You know, they told me that the courts don't work and that I shouldn't really put my faith in the courts. and that I'm going to have to find another way up out of prison. And, you know, I kind of discovered what they said kind of early on in my prison bid, like through my independent study. I'm in the law library reading, studying. And I was coming across these statistics saying like 90% of the people don't get action, and this is a consistent number, and in another court is a higher number. So one of the older brothers told me that, you know, these innocent projects had just started popping up and that I need to start writing them, lawyers, basically. And that's the way I kind of seen my freedom. My freedom was in trying to reach outside the prison, because not only did I didn't believe the coursework, but I didn't think that they would ever admit, you know, I wasn't in prison saying like a mistake happened. I was in there saying that I was framed by the police. They know I didn't do it. And they had a jailhouse. Like, it wasn't no physical evidence at all. They had a jailhouse informant come in and say that I confessed to him while I was in the precinct. And based on that alone, I did 27 years. And the information that he did testify to was information given to him by the police, you know. But once I was in there, I've seen it that I needed to start writing letters to people. And, man, you know, I tell people, man, at my high school, I went to the 12th grade, and it really couldn't have been nothing, because I couldn't, like, put a grammatically correct sentence together at the time. So I started, you know, just reading, buying books, trying to improve my reading. And through that, I started discovering the history of black people's struggles in this country for independence. I started reading a tremendous amount of Black Panther literature. I mean, just everything. You just imagine it. Historical. And it just started doing something to me, you know. So I'm trying to read to improve myself. But, you know, the struggle kind of taking hold of me. And it's just a mixture of things. You know, I'm already in here for something I didn't do. So I spent about 11 years in the hole, 13 years in max. And it kept me on this garbage called security threat group status, basically because I just wasn't accepting my status as a prisoner. And so it was a mixture of things that sort of built in my conscience. You know, I'm feeling like I'm wrong. And I'm seeing prison maybe in a different way. I'm seeing this system as an unjust system. And as I'm starting to read and learn about my people's struggle, I sort of started understanding why. So at some point I became an abolitionist. And not just in a prison sense, but in the sense that somebody had the power to do this, not only to me, but to so many other people in so many other ways. So that's about it, bro. I mean, let me say this. So I spoke to the brother a little bit earlier, and I was telling him that because of the situation that I've been through in life, I've had an opportunity to go places, speak, do interviews, et cetera. But I always see these as an opportunity for me to, you know, talk about issues and conditions or some along that matter. You know, I don't feel uncomfortable talking about myself, but I don't kind of see that as the role of, you know, why I've been given this platform, you know. So... I'm here with you, brother.
Yes, sir. That's understandable, man. It's understandable. You know, for the people who are listening, what exactly is an abolitionist, and why being an abolitionist is so important in regards to our plight as new African people?
Well, a lot of people. A lot of people ask me that, right? So I'm quite sure that abolition, it might like a lot of things, you know, that we debate on and go back and forth on. Abolition could mean a lot of things to a lot of people. In a nutshell, to me, it means ending harm immediately, right? If somebody is being harmed, it's natural to try to bring that harm to an end, right? And usually you try to bring it to an end as quickly as possible. So as an abolitionist, people are being harmed, and particularly black people, but poor and oppressed people in general are being harmed. And I want to bring that harm to an end immediately. And the way that I see to bring it to an end is to abolish the power that's actually causing the harm. So, and it's important to me for that because of what I'm saying. People are being harmed. I think a lot of times when we talk about issues, we sort of get away from that's what's at stake. What's at stake is people. You know, it's not so much as money or having the opportunity to do this. All of those things that are being denied, yeah, but at the heart of it, people are being harmed. And that's what's at stake. And that being at stake, I believe that the quickest way to bring it about, an end to it, is what me or anyone should be seeking. We should be seeking, how do we end this today? And abolition seems like the most sensible thing to me. I don't see why we would keep something, anything around that we know are harming people.
True indeed. I understand that. True indeed. You know, you got to destroy the system, man, you know, and recreate another one. They were revolutionary about change, total complete change. You know, in regards to your story, it's very interesting, right? You know, now that you're exonerated, how do you actually feel about other people that are wrongly convicted? How do you feel about that? You know what I'm saying? Or what type of stance will you take now in regards to the other people that are wrongly convicted, and also the aspect of how they relate to abolition as well?
I was at a conference last night at a Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and it was about juvenile lifers. And people were trying to inform the audience about the plight that juvenile lifers have been, you know, all the legislation and the things that are still necessary to try to bring the juveniles in there. One of the questions, the very first question that was asked to one of the juvenile lifers who is now out, he did 40 years in prison, was, what do you tell a family who said, I lost my son forever, so why should you not have to spend forever in there? So I'm in the audience. When I stood up, you know, because they have like a mic a section where you can ask questions or make comments, I said that I would like to answer that very first question that was asked, and I repeated the question again. And when I answered it, I said that I would tell them that the reason why that person should not spend the rest of their life in prison is because no one in this country should be in prison, period. Period. You know, it's a horrible system. You know, it has a horrible past. And it's working to do, I guess, what it was designed to do. So I say that in the far as innocence, yes, I do. I speak out about other men and women who are in there, but I speak out about the prison system in general. You know, I think that it's an unfair system. One thing we know for a fact, is that so-called people of color are treated different from the moment they have contact with police until whatever that conclusion is. There's just too much out there that says that's true. The same thing with women and gays, lesbians, transgender. The American criminal justice system is gender. And women, and like I say, lesbians, gays, transgenders, they have a different experience as well. And that different experience means unfair. You know, they have an unfair experience from the minute they have contact to the end. And it's the same thing when it comes down to how much money one has in this country. Often, and more often than people may admit, it impacts the type of justice that people receive, meaning it's unfair. You got money, you may have in 9 out of 10 a totally different experience. So I'm saying based upon that, that we know the system is unfair to this broad population of people in this country. You know, I'm working to bring everybody out of that. I don't accept the results of what I know to be unfair is legitimate. You know, I was telling somebody the other day that, you know, I'm from Detroit. I said if the Lakers came to Detroit and played against the Pistons and the refs were cheating, the scoreboard people were cheating all in favor of the Pistons, would nobody say, well, you had a chance to go out there and compete, which they did. They put their five best out there. Would nobody say, well, you lost? No, you didn't lose. No one would accept it as legitimate because they know someone was cheating. I don't care how hard they played. I don't care what the opportunity for them to put their people out there. No one would accept the results as legitimate if they knew that people were being unfair toward one team against the other. Well, that happens in the criminal justice system. We know that the criminal justice system is unfair to people of color, to women, to gays, lesbians, transgenders, to people who aren't rich in this country, who aren't affluent or connected. So how do you accept the results of it? So I don't accept the results of it for men and women who are unfortunately been charged with something that they have no culpability in. But I feel the same way for any man, woman, and unfortunately children in this country who are incarcerated.
Okay, I understand that. Yeah, mass incarceration is a major problem, man. The biggest business in the world, a multi-billionaire corporation. All the various and peers and capitalist corporations about it invest in and support, especially in privatizing it. My next question is, right, you said you're a new country, new African citizen, right?
Yes, sir.
What exactly does that mean to you, and why would you encourage somebody else to be a country, to declare their citizen as well? Why would you do that? For what reason? What did it actually mean to you?
So when I was in prison, like I said, I'm reading anything I can get my hands on. And it seemed like there was a small group of men in the Michigan prison who were reading new African literature, right? It was a small handful. And it was just something different about these brothers. And when I say different, I mean their perspectives, you know, the way that they seen things of that nature. And they started I got introduced to the Republic of New Africa through a group called Spear and Shield. These were brothers and sisters, for the most part, of Wusu Yaqui. I was reading what these brothers was writing, man, and it was doing something to me. You know what I'm saying? I was getting a different take on my situation as an individual, as well as my situation as an oppressed person, as a part of black people in this country. Conscious new African citizen, what does it mean to me? What it means to me is that I'm doing everything I can to exercise the rights that were denied to my ancestors. What I mean by that is if my ancestors were so-called freed in this country, if they were, as a free people, you have a right to determine your own destiny. You're free. You have a right to determine your own destiny. And that being so, looking at the situation that we were in coming out of Chattel slavery, there were options we had. We could have went back to Africa. We could have went to another country. We could have stayed in this country and voluntarily decided to join it, or we could have started our own thing. As a free people, at least those options, there may have been more, but at least those four options are options that should have been there for, because you're free. You make your own choices. Well, those choices were never given to our people. You know, America came out with something called the 14th Amendment and said anybody born or naturalized in this country, et cetera, is a United States citizen. They made the decision for my ancestors. They had no right to make that decision for my ancestors. As being a descendant of them, of those people who were denied those rights, I am doing what I can to exercise those rights. You know, I am a new African. I'm not an American. That was forced upon me. You know, that was forced upon my ancestors. And I don't like what was forced upon us. I don't like to see what's happening to us, and I realize something is happening to us. You know, I believe, like I say, in harm immediately, black people are being abused in this country by the government and by institutions, which are government. So, I mean, I don't know how other people may define it. You know, I'm quite sure there would probably be some debate, because it's debate on everything, but that's what it means to me. You know, I'm exercising the rights that were denied my ancestors. You know, just because time has passed, it's an old African proverb that that says just because you put a wood in the log, I mean, you put a log of wood in water for 10 years doesn't make it an alligator. You know, I take that to say it doesn't matter how long ago those rights were denied, they were denied, period. And why it's important? It's important because for me, to, as far as other people, to be conscious New Africans, to understand that we are an oppressed people, is because our situation can be different. Our situation could be different if we were free, meaning that we would have an opportunity to do things different. You know, people often ask me, because like anybody who's a critic or anything or has criticisms of things, it's often for people to ask you, what is the solution? And when I was young in my development, that would stop me because, and it was almost like one of those got you questions by some people, but I didn't have solutions. I didn't have solutions to say that this is the solution. But as time went on, I started to look at that question a little different. I realized that it was going to be impossible for me to have solutions if I didn't have the freedom to try what I wanted to try. You know, so I might say the solution to the police killing black people to pull all the police out of the community. I'm saying that's the solution, but I don't have an opportunity to try it, to put that theory to practice. I don't have an opportunity to do that. That's my solution, but I'll never have an opportunity to put it. It don't matter what it is. What's the solution with school? You have a problem with the school system, you know, let's pull that curriculum out. Let's put some sort of Afrocentric curriculum in there, some type of New African. No. My point is, how can I have a solution if I don't have the freedom to try what I want to try? And so I don't see black people having solutions to their problems under the current economic and political or social arrangements because they don't give us the freedom to try what we want to try. Not to be on some court steps begging someone, can you please stop shooting us? You know, we begging for that. Not to be on the court steps asking somebody after 5 or 6 years something. No, just having the freedom to try what I want to try. I don't see black people solving their problems because we don't have that freedom. We can have that freedom under a different set of social, economic, and political arrangements. One of our own making, one of our own liking. And that's why independence is important, and I think it should be important to all black people. How do you solve your problems and you can't do what it is that you feel needs to be done? So I think we need to create a situation where we can. And I think that independence is the way that black people solve their problems. And I think if black people want to solve problems, then being a New African, however you plug into this, and I do want to emphasize that, however you plug into it, you know, it's a lot of work to be done, and we don't all necessarily need to be in the same exact place or necessarily doing the exact same work. So however a person plug in, you know, I think it would be important for them to plug in some sort of way that puts us in the best position to solve our own problems. And that's being in control of ourselves and our situation and our destiny. And we're not at this moment.
True indeed. You know, it's wrong for everybody with the New African Independent Movement. You know what I'm saying? We need everybody bringing skill, talents, and abilities and make this New African Nation what it need to be, a success, a materialization, an actualization, you know. That was something for real, you know. Now I understood that you was in correspondence with certain New Africans, such as the late Choke Lumumba, New African political prisoner Adi Waluga by Shakir, right?
Yes, sir.
Tell me the type of inspiration or motivation did these brothers share with you through correspondence, or how did it even affect your life?
At first, Abdullah Shakir, there are some men and women incarcerated that, in spite of their incarceration, they in the struggle like anybody else in the struggle, and they use a great amount of their time and their energy to try to raise awareness. And Abdullah was one of those people and still is, you know, through his writing. I was, like I said, I started reading more. I kept coming across his name. We had a mutual friend, Dr. Farden, Boise State. She was running a farm called the Sojourner Truth Farm, and she had a newsletter that she used to spread awareness about prison conditions, and she put space in there for prisoners to write and tell their own stories, and Abdullah used that space to raise awareness about the New African plight. So, and at about the same time, I was reading a lot of Spear and Shield information. Like I say, Conrad George played a big role in my development. And everything I've been reading, I was reading it in Abdullah's writing. You know, so I, you know, recognized how well-read he was and informed. And like I said, we had a mutual friend, and as well as Dr. Evans, who was instrumental, as I know him, with the George Jackson University. And so I had an opportunity to start corresponding with him. And he was far more along in his development than what I was. So, you know, so just being able to have access to somebody who had, like I say, a more developed thought, you know, me trying to develop mine, and it made it easier, you know, to frame things in ways that I may not have framed them. Chokwe the Mamba, man, I don't even know where to begin. I met Chokwe when I was about 17 in Detroit, Michigan, where he's from. But I didn't know who he was. You know, I just know he just a brother, you know, an African brother, you know, one of those, you know, dashiki or something. I don't know much about him. But I met him, you know, had a few encounters with him. But when I was incarcerated and I started reading, I kept coming across the name Chokwe the Mamba. And I'm saying, like, how many people could be named Chokwe the Mamba? Knowing he was a lawyer, I found his address. Around this time, he was in Mississippi. And I started writing him. And I asked him, was he the man that I met many years ago that I keep reading his name in a book? And he said, yes, he had remembered me, you know. And I can't, you know, that made me feel away because, you know, the stuff I was reading in the book made him sound larger than life, you know, the freedom fighter, right? And from there, I started corresponding with Chokwe for maybe the next 17 or 18 years. And just, I mean, just remarkable brother, man. You know, his, you know, Chokwe was about freeing the land. And but just along the way, the friendship, you know, he was my friend. He was my mentor. He was a father figure. It wasn't nothing that man didn't do for me. And I used to feel so special that even when he became mayor, that, you know, he gave me several numbers. I'd be able to contact him. And whenever I needed something, even if I didn't get him, people in his law office as well as people in the mayor's office, when he was there, they knew that if I needed something, that Chokwe had it all together, right? So, I mean, Chokwe was just so much to me. You know, his death was like, you know, my plans was, for a long time, was when I get out of prison, I'm going straight to Jackson, Mississippi, because, you know, my guy there. And I'm finna go down here and be with my guy. So, you know, it was a big blow for me because I seen Chokwe as being a big part of my life when I got out. But remarkable man, you know, just all the different roles that he's played in the Malcolm X grassroots movement, the New African Independence Movement. I mean, just, you know, all the different things that Chokwe has done, all the things he's been a teacher, a leader, you know, a fighter, you know, the people's voice, just a remarkable guy. So, you know, I feel like I had one of the best that a New African representative, you know, and not to say, you know, but just one of the best as a mentor. And I tell people that sometimes, as far as my obligations and my responsibilities, I tell them that Chokwe was my mentor, and that means a lot. Chokwe was a giant, you know, so I say that to mean something that I got a big responsibility because my mentor was a giant, you know?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's understood. That's understood. You know, I also understand that you, you're CEO of your own network, the IDR Solutions, right? And you consider yourself a speaker, a writer, you know, and other things. So, what are the type of works that you push in regard to your solution, and what are the solutions? What is the solution in general? What do you mean by solution? What is that in general?
So, everything that I do, IDR. I got a trucking company, IDR Trucking. I have my company that I do speaking in my books under IDR Solutions. IDR is integrity, determination, and resilience. You know, it's a lot of things that got me through, but those are like three of the things that, you know, just being true to myself. You know, a prison is an environment where it seems like the whole goal is to break you, you know, just to break and crush the human spirit. To be able to go in there. So let me say this. I tell people this all the time, man, and I'm proud of this, man. You know, I was in prison 27 years, and I never got in a fight, right? I was in 27 years. I never stabbed nobody, nothing like that. You know, I was well-respected as a brother. You know, I wasn't in there. I wasn't no punk, things like that, but I was respected as a brother. You know, I read, I studied, I mentored. You know, I helped with homework. I wrote the articles about the prison conditions, et cetera. I was just a brother in there, you know, just a plain brother in prison, nothing super. But I realized that I could just be true to me. I ain't have to be nobody other than what I was. That's what I was the whole time. And the determination and resilience that it took, you know, and I try to put that out front because, like I say, what I'm about abolition, man. You know, me being in prison 27 years for something I didn't do, like I said, gives me a platform, you know, to go out here and speak. And I try to use that platform to share with people what I learned. Just quickly, early on in my development, somebody had given me some literature about behavior modification units, which is another name for solitary confinement, right? And I'm reading this information early on in my development, and the people are speaking, and this is professors or scientists, you know, criminologists, penologists. They all weighing in on solitary confinement, and they're speaking kind of frankly about the harm that they know solitary confinement is going to cause. Now, at the time, I'm in the hole. I've been in the hole about 7-8 months. The warden of the prison telling me I'm never getting out. Because I'm supposed, no, we're trying to start a prison riot. So they telling me I'm going to be in the hole. But as I'm reading this information, it's kind of blowing my mind that somebody would put somebody in a situation like this, knowing the sort of harm that it causes, right? So get enough of this information now. My thing is to read as much about this as I can so that I can arm myself, so that I can build some sort of defense, because what they talking about, prison and solitary confinement in particular does to people, I don't want it to happen to me. So I spent a big part of my time in prison studying prison. But I used to mentor young guys in prison. I would tell them that you're going to run across people in here who going to tell you they know everything about prison, because you're going to run across people who've been in here for all type of years, 10, 20, 30, 40. And it's difficult to tell somebody like that they don't know anything about prison. But what I would tell them is what they know is limited. Most people know what it feels like on their arm. Very few people really understand it from a penologist perspective or a sociologist or criminologist. Because, I mean, like, when do you get a chance to even come in contact with that perspective, right? Well, I did, and I sought that information out my entire time in prison. I made prison a study of mine. I made prison a study of mine once I understood what it did, because, number one, I didn't want it to happen to me, but I'm saying, why should something like this even exist? Something that has the sole purpose to crush people's spirit. You know, one of the things they call the so-called work they do is people work, and they relate people work to working on objects. And that's what it becomes for them. We become objects, and they're working on us to transform us into something. And it's not freedom fighters. It's not critical thinkers. You know, so it became important for me in there to fight that system. It becomes important for me to fight the system out here, understanding that that system is connected to a lot of other systems. It doesn't stand by itself. That system serves a purpose in this society the way that it is constructed right now. So I look bigger and beyond the prisons to understand that to solve problems in prison, you're going to have to solve larger problems in society. And the larger problems in society is about power. People do not possess the power under the current economic, political, and social relationship in this country to solve their problems, as I mentioned a minute ago. And I was telling someone yesterday, I was at that Calvin College, and I was telling them, well, I said, man, when we go to those steps of the mayors, and I'm paraphrasing, when we go to those mayor steps, or when we do these marches, I say, who are we talking to? Because the governor know, the mayor know, the president know. People know this because people do the work. It's like I'm saying we're not convincing somebody of something that they already know. And they know it. Things are in this society the way they are because they serve a purpose, even when they're harmful to people, or they wouldn't exist. And the fact that we got to go sit on a Capitol step and basically beg, that's essentially what the government makes people do. All the marches and the rallies, and I'm not belittling the work that people do. I'm saying when you really look at it, we on the court steps asking the government, please have the police stop shooting us. Why in the hell would we have to do this over and over again? See, when you're doing it over and over again, it's like you begging. It ain't no different if you ask somebody for something. If you ask for somebody for something over and over and over again, it wouldn't be strange for them to come around and say, bro, I'm tired of your begging. That's essentially what we do when we go ask over and over and over again because we don't have the power to just do it. Things that are harmful to us, we don't have the power to say something like we don't know. I mean, it'd be simple things in here. It could be something simple as a book. It's a book that we want to put in the school, and it turned into a five-year fight. We don't have the power to make decisions. There should never be something that we need to do, and it take us 5, 10, 20 years to do it. We can't solve our most basic and immediate problems because we don't have power. And that's why an independent struggle is important, because the independent struggle is about land. Land gives you power. Because land gives you independence. On your land, we can start creating social policies that better serve human beings. Policies that put humans at the center of what they're doing and not economics. And not who got it and who don't. So it's, to me, like I said, it's important for anybody that's really trying to solve their problem. They need to be thinking about, we need to solve our social, political, and economic arrangements that we have in this country. Because I don't care what we do, as long as those things stay the way they stay, the things don't stay the way they stay. Because that's what really controls shit. You know, it ain't people's personal behavior. It ain't if you pull your pants up, and as much as we know that we gods and we goddesses and things, it's not about if a person is calling somebody the N-word or not. We can stop, I told somebody this, we can stop doing all the things that people say we need to stop doing, and what effect is that going to have on white racism? What effect is that going to have on oppression? Not only that, people who say that, you know, things like we're our own best. Somebody said that the other day. We are our own biggest enemies now. Man, that's the most ignorant statement I ever heard in my life. I'm not bigger than the school system, and the school system is our problem. I'm not bigger than the criminal justice system. The criminal justice system is our problem. I'm not bigger than the political system. We are not our biggest problem. White supremacy has always been our biggest problem. And if black people can do everything right as they were doing, if all people got to do is think back about 60s, 70s, 50s, 20s. Black people were some of the meekest and humblest people trying to show trying to show that we were just as good as anybody else. And none of that shit mattered. None of it. None of it mattered. It didn't matter if you was a preacher. It didn't matter if you had a print shop. You could do the smallest thing and might end up on a tree. You know, we need the power to determine our own destinies. And to me, that is the only way we can do that, is have our own land so we can start to form on our own land what we want. And that requires a lot of things, as you know. You know, it's going to require a lot of things, but one of them is effort, and one of them for people to start realizing that we got a right to be free and that life could be different. You know, I have conversations with people, and I'll talk about putting anything in it. People say, man, you can't teach that in the school. I say, why can't you teach that in the school? Because that ain't what school design says who. Says who. A lot of the things that are the way they are now can be changed. People don't, everything that's in existence is not like, these are not universal laws. It's not gravity. These are things that somebody put down and that a lot of people realize are no good, but don't realize that they have the power to create something different. These are not, like I say, they're not universal law. These are, it's really some bullshit that somebody laid down. This isn't, there's nothing that's being done that's the so-called right way to do it. It's the way that the people who set this country up wanted to do it, and the people who continue to control the country want to do it, but it's not the right way. There are other ways to do things. I would like to explore some of those other things. And I know I'm going to have to be in a situation where I can do it. I got to be free. I can't do it right now because I'm not free. Even though I'm being out of prison, you know, I'm freer in the sense of I'm not confined in that cell, but I'm not free because I don't have the liberty to live my life. I don't have the liberty to live my life. I got somebody else making decisions, and I think they're horrible decisions. And I think anybody else that would be in a relationship with somebody who making horrible decisions that's affecting them, they try to get up out their relationship. And I'm trying to get up out of a relationship I'm with the government. I think it's a horrible relationship I'm in.
True indeed. True indeed. You know, I had one more question, then I'm going to ask you for your final thoughts in the show. I understand that you're writing a book called In Spite of the Consequences, and I also understand that you, what you stated earlier, them saying that it's not about you, everything is about exposing the systems and exposing what's going on. So is your book for the people, or would the book be more of a biographical thing, or would it be more for like a solution book for the people?
No, so it's funny because I just finished my foreword, and I put in the foreword that this is not a book filled with a lot of do this and do that type solutions. I was writing, my book is a collection of prison letters, sort of like George, you know. I mean, who can live in this man's shoes? But that's what I was thinking when I was writing it. Like, man, or when I had the opportunity to do a book, I said, I'm going to try to put a modern-day George together, right? And what I did is I had the opportunity to select letters where I was talking about the prison system, right? And I was trying to give some analysis of the prison system based upon, one, my experience, but, two, as I explained before, I was doing some extensive studying into the disciplines, criminology, penology, sociology, you know, 14 to 18 hours a day for years I stayed on my typewriter or I was in a book for the purpose of, once I realized what this system was, I wanted to be able to write about it. I wanted to be able to explain it to people, and I wanted people to understand why they should get in this fight to destroy it. So that's what my book is about. You know, my book is more criticism and critique and analysis than it is solution. You know, I think one of the things as far as like solutions, when we ask those sort of things, first, in order to solve something, you got to have an understanding of it. You know, and I wrote about a lot of different things but a lot of us don't have a real understanding of the human cost of incarceration. what it does to human beings, what it means to be in a system where your liberties are under siege, under arrest. What does it mean to be in a system where things like personality, charisma, influence, things that are natural to you are tried to be taken away because they have no place in a prison environment? You know, things like the work system in there, how meaningless it is. You know, they'll tell prisoners to keep a routine work assignment. And the routine work assignment is meaningless. But I wanted to explain these things in sort of like common language as I was through these letters. But I wanted to give it a sort of a more, you know, I wanted to talk about these things, having a greater understanding of them, hoping that we would. Because the solutions vary. There's even a lot of times, I mean, the ultimate solution is getting free. You know what I'm saying? But a lot of the things that's going to be done in the individual places we are, you know, it's not a lot of blueprints because they're individual situations that play out in different ways. So that's basically what it is. You know, I'm in the edited stage of the book. It'll be out sometime next year. I titled it In Spite of the Consequences because, as I mentioned before, I didn't get in fights in prison. I wasn't stabbing people, but I spent my entire time in segregation or in solitary confinement, or in a maximum security or under some jacked up security status because I wrote about prison conditions. And I was a revolutionary. I was an abolitionist behind bars. You know, so I wrote in spite of the consequences. You know, I would ride in places and people would know that Lucino going to be in solitary confinement sometime soon. You know, so in spite of that, right? You know, in spite of that, and there's no pat on my back for that because all the men and women who I know that have stood up against oppression, stood up against white supremacy, they all did it in spite of the consequences. You know, it's never been easy to push an independent struggle. An independent struggle has always been outlawed by the people who don't want the independent struggle to be successful. It's always dangerous work, you know, and it starts with maybe just being ostracized by people who don't understand or people who scared because they know. They know that people who stand up and fight for their rights, people who stand up and say that something is being done wrong, it's a history in this country of people being gunned down, murdered, killed, you know, something being done to harm them. But in spite of that, my ancestors stood up, and I have a responsibility to keep that fight going. You know, I've been talking to some guys out here in prison, out here in society, and they asked me why I was saying the things I was saying, and I say because those guys in there expect me to say it. I have a responsibility and an obligation to them as well. I have an obligation to those men and women who I left behind to do something to try to better their situation. And the only thing that I can really think that can better their situation for real, is to bring it to an end. And I don't know other way but try to end what's happening. And to me, that's why abolition fits right in line with our independence movement. Because we trying to abolish the powers to control our lives. People that are trying to determine, continuing to determine our destiny, and they're doing a horrible job, at least in my opinion, of it. You know, every time I hear all those statistics, and let me say this real quick, this is quick. One thing I learned is this. Whenever something happens over and over and over again, that means there's a pattern. Anytime there's a pattern, there has to be something in place that keeps that pattern going, or else it would be random. It wouldn't be a pattern. It'd be random. So anytime somebody sees something happening over and over and over again, they know it got to be structured. It got to be structural because something is keeping it in place. So every time we hear them horrible statistics, black people this in the job market, black people this in prison, black people this in college, whatever it be, and them horrible-ass statistics, I know it's something there keeping those statistics the way they are because they're consistent over time. That's why a lot of times we talk about it because they're not anomalies. It's not saying it wasn't a so-called one-off. we talking about it because, damn, it's been going on for 20 years, 10 years, however long. You know, I think the only way to bring that to an end is to have the power to determine your own destiny. You know, put it in my hands, your hands, the people's hands. So, and that's what my book is ultimately about. It's about abolishing the powers that are harming us.
True indeed, true indeed. I look forward to it. Can you give us a fine thought? What's your, leave it us fine, where you want to leave us some information, a quote, wherever you want to leave us. Give us your final thoughts.
My final thought is free to land, is what I've been saying the whole time. When people sit back and people think about solutions, I want people to go back on what I said about solutions. When somebody asks you what a solution is, they're basically saying, okay, what do you think should be being done? And when you say what should be being done, do you have the power to make it happen? In most cases, we don't. In most cases, when we propose what we believe to be the solution is, the powers that be us say, so we say, listen, man, just for my own mental health, for my own mental health, won't you get those statues out of here? Won't you get those monuments and stuff that revere races, revere some of the most horrible people there were, people that were owning people that were selling people, breeding people. I tell people all the time, Thomas Jefferson was a rapist. All that stuff about him being in a loving relationship, his slave was not in a position to say no. She wasn't. She was a slave, property. Just saying, look, man, we want to get this. We don't have the power to do simple things like that. To me, that should be the simplest thing in the world. Them men was horrible. You know what I'm saying? They was horrible. But just saying that, you know, it's about freeing the land, man. If people want to have a solution to their problem, you're going to need the power to put your solutions in effect. And we don't have the power under the current situation. So that's my final word. Anybody that's concerned about solving problems, whatever, I think the independent struggle is the only way we're going to do that. And the way to do that is to free the land.
True indeed, brother. I want to thank you for coming to our broadcast again, for sharing that understanding. Thank you for your words. Thank you for the work you're doing in the past, the present, the work you're doing in the future, and may success be upon you and your endeavors. I want to say free to land, everyone. If you have any comrades, associates, a friend, low, my high enemy, land, the inspiration, learning more about Georgia University. He actually can learn things from our Georgia University Facebook page, Georgia University Instagram page, Georgia University Twitter page, and also can contact me directly by sending me an email at boomanisecure80@gmail.com, and it's bomanisecure80@gmail.com. Law of the Resistance, Law of the New African Independent Movement. Free the land.
Free the land, brothers.
By the means necessary.